Okay, then I think we'll start with last hour, which is kind of intended to be the collective Q&A session. And I would like to invite our two keynote speakers who are physically here to join me. Okay, so what I would like to do is, because I'm sitting here, I'm taking the right to ask the first question or to kind of decide on the first question that or topic that we're going to talk about, which gives you a little bit of time to think about your own questions, because of course we didn't do Q&As after all the talks, and I'm pretty sure you also have questions for our guests here. So one thing that I kind of saw in all of the three talks was this, and sometimes even in the title, was this question about autonomy. And you talked about semi-autonomy. You talked about how companies have these illusions that they can control artificial intelligence, and clearly also some of the examples that Andreas gave were, showed us that there might be something that some technical component that is autonomous, that has some control over us. But isn't that just an illusion? That it's the technical side that somehow becomes autonomous, because the example with the AI. To me, it's always like, okay, an AI is determined by the data used to train the AI. And if there's bias in the data, okay, then I'm going to have bias decisions. And on the other hand, if things are truly autonomous, then are we at the point where, I mean, we all know corporations are people, my friend. So are we at the point where we have to say AIs are people, my friend? So this is kind of the first topic I would like to launch into this round, and you can just whoever wants to go first.
Well, I mean, what I tried to suggest is there's a dimension of discipline that distinguishes those three entities: humans and corporations and AIs, and as you go from humans to corporations to AIs, you get more disciplined. And I fear that we exaggerate our independence relative to the overlord that we're living within. So, humans exaggerate their independence relative to corporations. Corporations exaggerate their independence relative to their AIs. So, you know, I had the privilege of being one of the lawyers representing Frances Haugen, who was the Facebook whistleblower. And the striking thing from the Facebook files is, you know, Facebook's a company filled with incredibly decent people trying to make the company a good company so it does good things in the world. And they have lots of engineers who are focused on safety, and they're focused on how to make sure that bad information doesn't cause harm. But they're living within a structure that has a very powerful AI that's very transparently demonstrating that if they do the things that make the platform safer, they will lose revenue. And so, you know, you have these so many times where you have the engineers saying, here's what we need to be doing. And then management, as the handmaiden of the corporation and the AI, is saying, sorry, we're not going to do that because it's going to cost us in engagement. And this, I think, is what I fear, that we get ourselves inside systems where we can't resist because the system is so powerful in the instrumentality of its objective.
To this particular issue, I just wanted to say some of the questions which arise with AI are not originally really AI questions. For example, the question of freedom of speech, or who should, you know, be allowed to say something, is differently regulated in different countries. You have a Freedom of Speech Act in the United States, and even without AI, it is a constant issue. So can we now allow someone to make a sexist remark and not sanction him or her for that, or or identity, you know, hands offish, because we have a Freedom of Speech Act. And it has nothing to do with AI, it just reoccurs with AI when there is a more general mobilization against an election or something of that sort. So we need to see that some of the things that occur are just reproduced issues that we have in our society anyway, and that look differently in the US and in Germany, for example, but not in are not in principle different. It's always contested. And the other thing I wanted to say about autonomy, I firmly believe that we won't be able to keep the sort of autonomy because that autonomy was also an imagination. You know, we are the most intelligent animal in the world, and we deserve to be. It's an identity narrative we tell ourselves as humans. It was sort of never true, but of course it's. Also that we are confronted when you have something like GPT-3, why shouldn't a software that's able to collect a lot more knowledge than we can in a lifetime, even if we are very clever and study from day one, it's just an individual brain and a software that can tackle millions of brains, for example, or millions of pieces of knowledge, we just know more. And why shouldn't we, how can we not use that? The question is what we use it for. Mm. So it strikes me as, so when a Nobel Prize winning physicist says, yeah, I mean, if I have an interlocutor who with whom I can really talk about lattice theory in physics, and you know, I can raise certain issues and they would have an answer, why should I forego that? Conversation. Mm. I would like to have it. I would like to have someone with me all the time with whom I can talk. During the pandemic, for example, you missed talking your discipline with people because you were isolated, all of us. And it was focused on particular occasions, but you couldn't keep up a conversation. It would have been nice to have a sociology expert Siri or someone to keep talking. Something to. We will not avoid that, I believe. We will have to come to grips with some sort of semi, what we can call now vaguely semi-autonomy arrangement. Because it's our collective knowledge and our collective knowledge in many ways that confronts us. And that's simply more than what individuals can do.
Mm-hmm. I think AI amplifies whatever we have as humans. AI learns the patterns that we have, and at the end of the day, maybe it is not that pretty if you analyze what people say on any of the public corpuses, for instance, on Reddit or Twitter or whatever. So in some way, it is not really having a mind of its own or anything like that, but it just summarizes pretty well who people are, and that might not be how we want to see ourselves. And so this amplification of the human self that AI produces, I think, surfaces things that people don't like to see.
But Andres, I would push back on that by citing your own student, Tristan Harris, because the point is not that the AI is just reflecting us. The point is the AI tied to the business model of engagement is amplifying the worst of us. It's suppressing
absolutely.
The worst of us and amplifying the worst of us. So it's
absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. It is the AI as filtered through and financed by the information military industrial complex.
And you said many of the things that we deal with are not fundamentally new, and we just heard that AI amplifies things. and you tie it back to money, which rules the world. So would it be fair to say that we're actually not, we don't need to solve new problems? They just have been amplified, but the essential problem that we have to solve is how much capitalism do we want? Because that, I think, is a fundamental difference between the US and, for instance, at least the European Union. I mean, coming from Switzerland, it's still a little bit more like the US, but is this maybe at the core that there are these strong financial interests and now they have found a tool which is much more powerful than putting people into factories, making them work for 12 hours and exploiting them in this way. Now they found an amplification that makes all these problems really, really urgent.
Yeah, I mean, it's a typical conflict between American and European, because you're framing it as capitalism or, and I would frame it as, look, there's always been capitalism, always regulated. And so it's always how you regulate capitalism, yeah. Right? So that
was actually my point when I said, how much capitalism do we want?
Okay, I'm not understanding. It's my fault. I'm not understanding how you're framing it. But what I think it's important to identify is you're not going to eliminate the profit motive, but government needs to take a role in steering the profit motive where there is an externality to society. And we haven't had to experience externalities like this before. So in one sense, yes, you're right. This is nothing new. We've always had people saying crazy things out there. There've always been, you know, people blathering crazy stuff. Like Donald Trump in 1976 was just as crazy as Donald Trump in 2016. The difference is that in 1976, he didn't have a button he could push and have his craziness spread and amplified by infrastructure that profited from spreading his craziness. Mm-hmm. In 1976, you had television networks, which were like, we're not going to put that guy on the news. Why would we put that guy on the news? That guy's a crazy man. And so this is now an externality about speech that we've never had to deal with before. And then your point about the First Amendment becomes really important. The United States is particularly disabled from dealing with this issue because of a radically extreme First Amendment. And European nations are much better able to deal with this issue because you have a more balanced conception that would play. But this is, I think, a new problem, even if the inputs are things that we've been dealing with since the beginning of humanity.
Can I say one additional thing? Is, I mean, I fully believe in some sort of regulation or whatever it would be, but I don't that much believe in government. We have so many crazy governments in the world. And I have the impression that there are really incidences where the governments, powerful governments, like in the US for a while, were very dangerous, slow and dangerous and dumb. And, you know, I often thought while Trump was still in power, algorithms couldn't do it worse. There's no way they would do it better, because they could be fed, you know, all sorts of experience with wars and this and that and the other and the rules and what science knows. And they wouldn't say things that he said. So I think the problem is deeper on two levels. And one is the trust in government, or the way government can still function as it used to function for a while, at least. That sort of democracy may also be historically specifically successful and then no longer successful. And the other issue I have forgotten now. No, the other issue is I don't believe that we can solve everything by going back to capitalism. There's also culture wars in the US. It's not just corporations trying to make money. There's also cultural misunderstandings. And some of this was hidden, and it's brought out through, amplified through social media, but also through the pandemic. You found yourself in a country that you don't know anymore, that you didn't think existed. Suddenly it's visible. Mm. And so there is...
But those are related,
other things,
right?
Going on, like cultural things. That
but those are related, right? That yeah. is, it yeah. is because it's profitable uh-huh. to amplify the cultural yeah. wars yeah. that these platforms amplify the cultural wars. Yeah. CNN, I mean, cable news, Fox News, yeah. Breitbart, Facebook, they profit from making it like yeah. that. So these are not separate, right? It's the same dynamic, isn't it?
Yes, they amplify it, I believe so, but there is something there that yes. there's differences and diversity in the population that maybe perhaps it didn't exist, perhaps it could be better eliminated by education for a while, perhaps the education system doesn't work well, yeah. but it's there, it goes beyond, also on a global level, I think it goes beyond capitalism being the only enemy there.
Thank you, Larry, for your remarks. I agree. I think the weapon we have is that of education. If you think about how literacy has changed, that a few hundred years ago, it was enough if you could follow characters and know where a priest was reading out of the Bible. Now I think we really need much more literacy, media literacy, and more close to my home discipline, of course, data literacy, of knowing what is plausible, what is simply impossible. And I think here at the university, we should think, how can we really increase data literacy or media literacy by having people critically ask questions about, you know, where the sources are. We know so little through direct experience. Think Ukraine. What can we do in the plethora of information that's out there to increase trust and to know how to allocate our scarce resource called attention?
Thank you. I think there are hands, but before I give the mic over, I want to do a shameless plug here. That's exactly why the university has the advanced data and information literacy track since 2 years introduced in the latest round of the Excellence Initiative.
I would like to come back to the topic of autonomy. And by introduction, I might say that I'm a lawyer by training. For a lawyer, it is quite normal when we talk about autonomy that autonomy goes hand in hand with accountability. And in the presentation by Ms. Knorr Zetina, we heard that algorithms in trading are treated like humans. So they are doing the same job. Sometimes they are doing it better or even worse. Very often they interact with humans. This is what you call semi-autonomy. So you depicted algorithms being treated as autonomous entities. My question is, what does it mean in terms of accountability? We as lawyers are accustomed to the idea that accountability can only be for human individuals. Human individuals can be held accountable. So who is held accountable if something goes wrong with an algorithm in this trading scenario? Who is being held accountable, or who should be held accountable? Is it AI that should be held accountable because we treat it as like a human entity? Should it be the guys who are doing the programming? So what is the in your perspective, but the question does not only relate to you, but to all three of you, what is the interrelationship between the autonomy issue and the accountability issue? Thank you.
It's actually an area where this problem has been addressed by government. because a market is supposed to play by some fair rules of fairness. And government, the SEC, for example, Security and Exchange Commission, and equivalent units in different countries observe the markets and request data. So there are markets which are outside of that, of course, which are not. But what is traded through exchanges? Exchanges have the obligation to give their data to these overseeing agencies, and they can check, was the market done in a regular fashion? And the SEC has held core. It did not, in one of the crashes, for example, it did not sanction the corporation that had left an algorithm that shouldn't have been there, sort of in the operating room, and it got used at a false moment and almost killed the corporation. That was Knights Capital. They had to be bailed out. But the SEC did not impose any sanctions on the company, but it did file a complaint against it. It did tell you, you cannot go on like that. And it required the EU and in the United States, the equivalent. The United States has now followed completely suit, but the EU has followed, has issued regulations that pertain to financial markets and force the companies to indicate which algorithms they used for what. This is a complicated issue because the algorithms, these are programs, they are not automatically separate like a human entity. They are not corporeal, you know. So one program and another one and three and five programs cooperate. And additional issues because the companies were saying, this is proprietary information. We built these algorithms. They mustn't be disclosed. You kill us that way. You give it to the competition. We have invested a lot in these trading algorithms. So the overseeing agencies said, we can't do it that way. We can't kill all the banks, you know, for we need financial markets urgently. I mean, financial markets are really about credit. If we lose credit in this kind of capitalist society, we lose everything, almost everything. So credit is important. And the overseeing agencies didn't want to go that far, but they found ways of tagging the algorithms, you know, of issuing, of saying certain codes need to be attached to certain kinds of transactions so that we can follow back up. If there is a disaster, we can follow it and we can see who let this algorithm loose. You cannot make the algorithm accountable like a corporation. I mean, it's not clear how you would do that. It's not, you would have to incorporate it first and treat it like a legal entity, like a corporation or something. That has not been done. But they do tag it. They have implemented this in Europe with the help of a German model, by the way, and was one of the first ones. And it's well documented. So accountability happens via the user who is using the algorithm if something really terrible happens. But, of course, it's a market, you know. So you're not getting compensated fully if you have a major crash, flash crash, and you lose all your money. It's unlikely that you will get compensated fully for that.
The one context where we will see lots of accountability is autonomous vehicles. Which embed algorithms about how to deal with conditions on the roads. And there will be reviews as somebody's killed by a decision a car makes about whether those algorithms make sense or not. And it's interesting, it's been a revival in philosophy departments of classical philosophical dilemmas, you know, the trolley problem, like, you know, to really work out what should the law actually be implementing, which solution, a Kantian solution, or, you know, you tell me, the utilitarian solution. And there'll be a lot of litigation about that until it's eventually regulated by statute and puts it off. But then the question becomes, the question will come back to the responsibility of the corporation that programmed the vehicle. less than the driver, to the extent the driver is not making the judgment.
So regarding regulation, as you mentioned already, and in your talk also, you mentioned the aim for regulation of the use of the data. And I was wondering whether you would have further ideas how to specify how you want it to be regulated. More general terms, and also how you want to enforce the regulation, since I think that's also the problem with the market you just mentioned. Well, we can track it afterwards, but then the ship is already gone.
Yeah, I think that a good parallel here is to think about pharmaceuticals. You know, for most of the history, until the 20th century, drugs were, formula that were put into the marketplace. And if they were poisonous and they killed people, then you sued the person who put it in there, and it was obviously impossible to find them, and it was a very bad market. And then at a certain point, the government stepped in and said, okay, look, if you're going to be putting drugs into the marketplace, you got to show that they're safe and effective first. So there's a process of like demonstrating that they're safe and effective. And some people are talking about creating the same sort of structure with any business that's using personal data, for example. So if you're going to be a business around personal data, you've got to go through the equivalent kind of regulatory structure. And I imagine the critical question the regulator wants to understand is the business model question. What's the way you're using? How are you profiting from using these data? And some business models, I think, are harmless, and some, I think, are harmful. But that's the kind of choice the regulator would have to make. Now, there'd be the same question about trade secrets, but we do have regulatory agencies that get lots of data that they don't report to the public. For example, taxing authorities. Taxing authorities learn all of your financial information. If that were released to the public, that would be very bad. That might be very bad for you competitively. But we have structures to protect the integrity of the data that's being shared there. We could build the same thing in this context, so that we could begin to. I think you need to regulate business models that have an externality in the market for personal information that we want to find a way to disincentivize or to ban.
Thank you so much for those talks. They were very insightful. I've got a question for you, Professor Lessig. You talked about the business models as a way to try to find a solution for the problem. I think it might also be about the users of the product itself. So the business model itself might just be for the use of a certain way, but the users might make use of it in a completely different way. So we might have a problem with the users as well. So maybe it's not only about the business model per se, but also the use of the user. And we can't really, unless we find a way to make it impossible to use the product in different ways that are harmful, we can't really control it totally. There's always risks of outmaneuvering it.
So I think there are two points. First, there's a concept of good enough for government work. So you're right, we're never going to perfectly control. That's just not on the table. It's not an objective. We've got to get as close as we can. And then the question about the user versus the business model, I guess I would wonder whether, I would say, does the business model profit from the way that the user is using it? So, for example, if you had a business model that enabled people to stalk, former lovers or stalk people, or like this Clearview AI, like be able to use it to stalk people on the street and find them and find their addresses and so forth, then that is, in a sense, the business model of the platform. Like if it's profiting from that use, I think you account for that as the business model. If it's not a business, it doesn't have profit from the use. It's like, know, if it turns out that Wikipedia is being used for some really nefarious purpose, not because Jimmy Wales designed it like that, it just happens this is the way it's being used, then I think it's exactly the problem you've described. What do we do when a platform which is not leveraging or benefiting from the particular use is being used in a nefarious way? And I think the answer to that is, this is not a one-size-fits-all regulatory regime. We've got lots of different types of regulations we need to think about, and they have to complement each other. So I guess I would think about a different tool to deal with the problem, that narrow problem you were describing. But if it's related to the business making money, I think that's a business model issue.
Thank you so much for your talks. My question is, how can we deal with the problem, or how can we solve the problem that we want to have some sort of explainable AI? We want to understand what we do, but the companies say it's our secret.
What you say, there's not one model fits all. So it would depend a lot. There is the right of business to protect its information. If it is an advantage, if it has developed it, if it's an advantage, if the business depends on it, you can't just make it open source suddenly. That has nothing to do with AI. That's just a competition question. But on the other hand, if the information is damaging beyond the right of business to protect itself, in the financial area, the actual regulatory bodies acknowledge the right of business, like a copyright they have on algorithms, for example. They have the copyright. It doesn't help them anyway because others copy the algorithm. They understand what they are doing and they get copied and they have a lifetime of 3 to 6 months maybe, but often 3 months before they are no longer useful because they have been copied. But you cannot take that away by regulation from business. So it would depend, I think, on what we are talking about, which business.
Yeah, I completely agree. It depends. But I think it's also important to say we should insist on transparency in certain contexts. So where an AI is aiding the government to help the government regulate,
then just like a lawyer helping the government needs to make her arguments transparently and publicly, the device needs to make its arguments transparently and publicly. We've had this fight in the United States where AI companies produce technologies to enable judges to decide parole. And initially, you know, the lawyers for the defendants would say, I want to know what your algorithm is. And the companies would say, no, we're not going to tell you, it's our trade secret. And the courts initially accepted that. That's idiotic. What the courts should say is, if you want to sell your technology to the courts, okay, here's the requirement. We've got to have a way of understanding how the regulation you're implementing is working. And if we don't, we're not going to buy your technology. We're not going to pay you for technology. And that might mean there are fewer companies that can make money there. That's not the end of the world. It seems to me the important thing is the value of transparency and understanding why the government is regulating one way versus another, rather than enabling the secrecy.
Thanks so much. I really liked your analogy of the FDA regulation and approval of drugs. My question goes a bit like this. For FDA regulation of drugs, it's relatively straightforward what the endpoint is that you want to optimize. So it's some sort of health indicator, right? So there's a new drug against cancer, and you have a relatively clear indicator, cancer gets better or doesn't get better. With a similar regulation model for products that use personal data, do we know what the endpoint actually is? I'd be really interested in your ideas, what the endpoint would be. So if you have, say, that regulatory model, or actually any idea, so what's the endpoint? So what should be, if to use Andreas's words, what should be optimized the function towards?
This feels like the hardest question, so I'd love to hear the answers from the other two, because I'm not sure. I think Andreas is right about how to think about what the AI is trying to do. I think the regulator's question is different. think the regulator's question is, can we understand the use of the personal data in this way will produce some kind of negative externality for society? And if we don't see it will produce a negative externality, then fine, go ahead. And the second dimension of that might be, can we see, do we imagine that everybody who's affected by this, you know, so Andreas and I had a similar example about the insurance story. Every single person who's affected by that insurance story is against it. The only people who are for it is the insurance company. And so that's another context in which you could imagine a regulator picking out that class of cases and saying, no, you're not going to use personal data for that. And it's almost like a Rawlsian veil of ignorance, like putting, you know, imagining yourself behind the veil of ignorance. You don't know if you're an insurance company or a person. And then you ask, is this the right way for these personal data to be used? And if you have a strong, if there's a strong judgment it isn't, then it should be forbidden. If there's a strong judgment that it is, it should be allowed. And then a narrow slice of cases, I think you've got to allow people the choice to opt in or opt out from. Rather than everything, which is basically where we are in the United States right now, and I wouldn't want nothing. I don't think there's like a perfect way to answer every question, but a much smaller set of those questions should be open for people to engage.
Because I think that, I mean, if you can hear me through the speakerphone, the question was also partly directed at you, because you mentioned this optimization function, and Lars Lessing had this analogy with the FDA that, and of course with the FDA, it's the optimization function is quite clear when we look at the drug, but with AI, it's maybe not so clear what we want to have. And I was wondering whether you might have some comments on that.
Yeah, thank you. So I think FDA example is a good example, which shows how difficult things are. What we need, for instance, specifically, let's say, on cancer drugs, we need to figure out as society how much are we willing to pay Roche or a pharma company for what, and what are the side effects. So things are not black and white, but the discussion on what the weights are in front of the terms, for example, how do you trade off the length of life versus quality of life? Those, I think, are the key questions which we have to address as society. And having a discussion that is not black or white, and discussing the ingredients, I think, is progress over just binarizing it and saying this is good and this is bad, this is evil, this is good.
At this point, some of these things are systems problems. So apologies to Christian Meyer for talking on that abstract level. But it seems to me that legal systems differ between countries. And for example, what I observe in the United States, that if you have financial problems, determining the externality is very complicated, because the population is not unified and the legal opinions are not unified, and you end up having all kinds of trade-offs playing against each other. The company will suffer, and that's bad for the people, or the company will not suffer. You know, it is not clear what the externality is, not a simple thing to determine, because it has additional effects, and there are feedback effects, and you don't want to destroy the companies and so on. And you can observe that some of the negotiations take forever. The legal negotiations take forever. And so my question to a seasoned lawyer would be, this overview over different legal systems, is there something on the system level that would make one system better suited to deal with these sort of indeterminate, determination problems, where you can't come to easy solution, even if you bring in lawyers, you bring in counter lawyers, and you continue to negotiate? And what legal system would be better suited to come to conclusions Is this a question one cannot answer, or is it a question that is the case law, for example, in the UK, is that better suited than a German legal law, which would be a very different sort of structure?
Well, I mean, first, you're completely right. Many of these questions are extremely hard. And there's no determinate answer to, is this an externality or not? But that's different from saying there are no questions that are answerable or easy. And I think some are easy, and we at least ought to be able to move there. But the second part of your question is a really important and hard part question, which is, which legal structure is better able to address it? And I would bump the abstraction level up one higher. I don't think that it's useful to think of continental versus the Anglo-American system. I think the distinction is interested versus disinterested legal systems. So the United States Congress is a completely dysfunctional governing body. It can't make any decision in a way that is maximizing anything that we think should be maximized. What they maximize is campaign finance contributions. That's what they're maximizing. And they're constantly sensitive. I mean, you know, this number is commonly understood in America, but people outside of America can't believe it. Members of Congress spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money. And they're raising money from the very people who they're regulating, and they're raising money and therefore learning how to avoid making the people they're raising money from angry. So that's an interested legal system. And that's going to be a terrible legal system for answering this question, because they're constantly going to be asking not the core question, is there an externality, but is there an externality on my ability to raise money? Now, you can have regulatory agencies that are disinterested. You know, they really, you know, I think you might have views about the politics of the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court doesn't make decisions caring about whether they're making somebody angry or not. Their job doesn't depend on it. Their money doesn't depend on it. Nothing depends on it. And so I think they can make a judgment, however, whether they're well-informed enough to make it is a separate question, but they can make a judgment that's not interested in this way. And I think we ought to be focusing on how do we get regulatory infrastructure that can be asking these questions in a disinterested way, recognizing, as you say, Karen, it's absolutely right, very difficult in some contexts, maybe should not even be attempted in some contexts. But we have enough context where the disastrous consequences are so apparent that we ought to be stepping in and doing something about it.
Yeah, I think one way to look at it is that not making a decision in many cases also is making a decision. And I think a good frame is always to see what is the alternative. So yes, there are shortcomings to everything, but trying to balance what are the side consequences, in some cases also what are the unintended side consequences. So I think asking what's the alternative is an important question here, rather than just looking at it in the abstract.
I don't want to make a lawyer statement, since many questions from legal research were asked already. Can you hear me, Andreas? I hope it works. Well, but I want to agree with what you just said, so at least saying that I'm also coming from the law perspective, and I want to add something and say, I wonder if the regulation really is our problem. And now I want to add, and I have to say, cite my question, because the question is actually not mine, it's the question, my brother is also here, like he's somewhere out there and listening to us. He teaches at the Pratt Institute in New York, and we're discussing those things for and back. He's a professor of psychology. And his question is, Martin, now you're here and I'm citing you. So not a legal question, but it's also mine. And we had lots of discussions back in New York for that. It seems to me that one of the common consensus on that stage, and I agree with you, Martin, is that we need better education, better information literacy, digital literacy, and so forth. Like, you know, you talked about loving data, and we have to come along with that, should lose our fears. Well, on the epistemological level, Martin wants to ask us, And I also agree with this question. Isn't that the same kind of enlightenment ideology which got us into the mess? In other words, shouldn't we question the general appeal of data, the necessity of data, the right to collect data, rather than trying to educate the users? I leave it with that.
So let me just rant for a bit about how good data is, how important data is, like how much better the world is with more data. I mean, we have an extraordinary number of problems in the world, people suffering and starving and climate problems, all of which will only be addressed by massively increasing the amount of data we have to be able to make analysis. Now, my fear is that we're going to massively increase the amount of data we need to make analysis without any of the protections that we need to be building in for the harmful consequences of those data. So I'm not saying this is a reason to go full force in one direction without a brake or without a steering wheel. But I think the idea that, it's easy for us, relatively wealthy white people in the world to sit back and say, well, things are fine as it is. What do we need data for? We'd be fine. Germany would be just fine. America would be just fine. Cambridge will survive. But the problems that the world faces are huge, and they require a rationality that is not going to be achieved in a philosophy department. It's going to be achieved in a data science department. It's going to be achieved in a data science. It's going to be achieved here. Konstanz will be where it's achieved, because it's the integration of these different perspectives together that will give us a way of making progress. That's a little of a rant, but I flew in last night, right? So I'm really tired, and my brain's losing it right now. So I apologize for that.
That was perfect. We'll put that on our webpage.
Sure. I think of it, we have human rights. And similarly, I think we should think about rights towards the data we create, whether we know it or not. And those rights, for me, fall in two categories. Transparency rights, the right to see. What data does an organization collect about me? What do the algorithms do with the data they collect? And the rights to do, the right to port my data, to take it elsewhere, the right to annotate my data, and so on. So I think for me, the perspective I would take here is to think, what rights should we have? And I'm not a legal person, but I think, there are ways probably of making that into something where we can hold organizations, whether they are governments or companies, accountable for obeying those rights and fining them if they don't.
Thank you very much. I think we are at the end of this time slot. Then I, with these two microphones, I would like to thank you, Karinkno Cetina, and you, Lawrence Lessing, and I hope that in the end we got you some audio to San Francisco, and I also would like to thank you, Andreas Wiegand, for your participation in this very interesting panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And